You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
Briggs in New York, in for Emily Chang, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, Tesla CEO Elon Musk planning to shed 10% of staff as corporate America turns up the volume on all of these economic warnings. We have the story. Plus, well, speaking of Elon Musk, he's one step closer to buying Twitter. The social media company says that a regulatory waiting period has expired. We'll discuss the next steps. And of course, a big preview of Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference. Coming up quickly on Monday, developers are going to gather in person for the first time in years. What can we expect? We'll break it all down for you. Let's stick with today's jobs market. The market moves, of course, those job numbers really coming thick and fast at 8:30 a.m. this morning. I want to do all of this with Crossmark's chief market strategist, Victoria Fernandez, and talk to us sort of about, you know, sort of the decent, the good jobs numbers and how we're thinking about the way that that impacts the Federal Reserve that certainly needs to be on the move.
Yeah, Taylor, I think we had some conflicting stories this morning coming out of the jobs report. Obviously, it was a little bit bigger than expected. And so therefore, people were concerned that the Fed is going to continue to raise rates, maybe even faster than what they've telegraphed so far. They've telegraphed 50 basis point moves at the next two meetings. September, they're saying, is open. Perhaps the jobs report today makes a 50 basis point move in September more likely. But I think we also have to look at the average hourly earnings. That stayed flat versus last month. And this is where we're really going to see, the inflation component dig in, that sticky component of inflation coming from wages. And we didn't see the gain there that many people thought. And we saw the participation rate go higher, which, again, could help bring wage inflation down a little bit. So a little bit of a mixed story, but I do think the Fed is going to continue to go full force at this point. And that's why we saw the markets react the way they did today.
And is that why tech continues to be the big underperformer, just struggling to be outperforming in a yields rising kind of environment?
Yeah, obviously, when yields go higher, those tech names, those what we consider long duration stocks, tend to not do well. But look, even when yields went down over the last 10 days or so, we had yields come back off of that intraday high of a 320. And we didn't see tech do tremendously well. We didn't see them take leadership. You still have energy taking leadership right now. So that has to make us think that there's not going to be a big shift and we're going to be in a big upturn for the markets. It makes us think we are just having a little bit of a bear market rally right now with energy still leading. So I think you have to be careful with tech. There's a lot of volatility around those names with yields constantly moving, but I don't think you want to remove them all from your portfolio. You still need some exposure there.
It was interesting, though, the strategist over at Bank of America said that tech is a huge laggard in sort of this stagflationary environment and that growth is the laggard, that this sort of outperformance that we've had as of late is such an anomaly that really the trend is towards value. Are you viewing value outperformance in if we get a stagflationary environment?
Yeah, we actually like value better here. When you look at our 10 predictions that we put out on December 31st, we talked about value versus growth. And what we've seen since the beginning of the year is that roughly about half of the outperformance from value over growth has kind of dissipated, but yet it's still performing better. So we have a balanced portfolio. We've trimmed a little bit of our value names, but we're still overweight that. We still have growth names in the portfolio. We think with all the volatility that's coming, value may still outperform, but you want to make sure that you have a good balanced portfolio, and that's where we're having our clients position themselves.
Victoria, it's interesting. We were speaking with Rick Reeder over at BlackRock earlier this morning, talking a little bit about the Federal Reserve and, dare we say, sort of a Goldilocks-ish environment. Take a listen to what he had to say.
This will do nothing to deter the Fed from where they're going. But I think it's a big report because I think we're now going to make the turn. I think the next 3 or 4 months, you're going to see these numbers decline. I could see a negative print over the next 3 or 4 months. And that's the thing that I'm keyed into. And I think that's what markets will react to and try to interpret how deep the Fed's going to go.
Is that sort of peak jobs, what we just got?
Yeah, I listened to that interview this morning, and it was interesting that he's expecting negative numbers to come out. And I'm really kind of along those lines. I do think that we're going to see the labor market really start to come down. And look, the Fed has told us they are willing to sacrifice some of the strength in the labor market in order to bring inflation down. So I think we have to expect that that is actually going to happen. We talk about peak inflation, peak yields. I think we have to also speak about peak labor market and how we're going to see some of those smaller companies, you know, that's where they've been hurting the worst on some of the labor cost issues. If they start laying people off in those lower paying jobs, that's definitely going to affect the labor market reports coming in the next few months.
Finally here, what's the biggest question you're getting from clients at this moment?
You know, it's interesting. We just hosted a Q&A with clients this week where they could just call in and ask questions to our CIO, Bob Dahl, and myself. The biggest question we got was about recession and inflation. Mm-hmm. And so we're telling people we don't expect a recession this year. Household balance sheets are strong. Corporate balance sheets continue to do well. Are we going to see growth slow down a little bit? Yes. But we're not at the level with the labor market, with earnings. We're not at the level yet that we think we're going to go into recession. We're looking, if that happens, maybe second half of next year, but we still think the economy will hold pretty strong here for the rest of 2022.
Really appreciate it. Crossmark's Chief Market Strategist, Victoria Fernandez, happy Friday. And that sort of leaves us off at a really good note when we think about recession. Is that the biggest question that clients are asking? Is that the biggest question that corporate CEOs, like Tesla's CEO, Elon Musk, is asking? He now actually comes out today saying that he's aiming to cut around 10% of salaried staff from the company, saying that he, quote, has a super bad feeling about the economy. Dan Levy, of course, over at Credit Suisse, joining us now. How are you thinking about if this is sort of an idiosyncratic Tesla issue, or are you a little bit worried this is a broader EV, broader economic issue?
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Taylor. We were surprised by the headline simply because Tesla is in uber growth mode. We know there is a lot of capacity that's coming online. They need support staff to support that growth. So the headlines came as a bit of a surprise to us. You know, yes, we're getting more questions from investors on the risk of recession. But the main thing that I would just point out is that Tesla and the auto industry broadly right now, the primary issue is actually not demand at the moment, but it's really supply. This is a supply-constrained industry. Anything that's produced will be sold. When you look at U.S. auto sales, 12.8 million SAR in May, much lower than the typical 17 million SAR that you would get. That's because you have inventory at all-time lows. So the largest problem right now is supply. And in the case of Tesla, they need staff to support supply, increasing that supply and unlocking that volume.
Is this why maybe you, well, I don't want to say you sound confused, but some of your counterparts, Morgan Stanley's Adam Jonas, the CFRA analyst, saying that this sort of goes against what they were thinking when you talk about ramping up production, of increasing that supply, needing the staff that you can in the factories because the demand is there. Are you, could I say that maybe there's some confusion there as well?
I think confusion is the right way to look at it. It is a little bit of a surprise for a company that is in uber growth mode, and that I think it probably has a very long-term view. They have, you know, something like $18 or $19 billion of cash on the balance sheet, so they're well insulated. It is a little bit of a surprise. Now, I think to give credit to Tesla, or maybe to understand partially what's happening, this is a company that even with all of the padding that they have on the balance sheet, they are very cost focused. We actually just had a field trip to the Fremont factory last week, and you still see this is a very cost focused company, even with all of the improvements in margin. So I don't know if it's something along those lines, but yes, for a company that has a lot of growth ahead, that needs to increase the volume and needs to increase the support staff to support that volume, it was a slightly surprising headline.
Really appreciate it. Your time and the fundamental analysis. Dan Levy, of course, over at Credit Suisse. Really, really appreciate your perspective there. Let's talk about that stock split. Amazon's 20-for-1 with the first split adjusted trading. It all begins on Monday. Now, remember, the split was announced back in March. Shares initially got a boost, but then, of course, April and May came really falling here with a lot of the tech volatility. What does the split mean for investors? Joining us now, Michael Pachter, Managing Director of Equity Research over at Wedbush Securities. And we know the math, the intrinsic value hasn't changed for the company, but does the psychology, the consumer sentiment around the stock change at all for you?
Yes. I mean, Taylor, I think that the idea of a split is to make the shares appear more affordable. And obviously, institutions don't care, but individual investors do and employees do. So it allows the company to be more appealing to individual investors. You know, and if you have $10,000 to invest, are you going to buy 4 shares of Amazon? You know, maybe not, but you might buy 100 shares at 120. It's been 12,000. I think that's how they're thinking about it. Same with employee compensation. You know, I have a friend who went to work there, and I remember they gave him 223 shares of stock vesting over 4 years, and it was just really complicated. They can push comp down now, stock-based comp down to even fulfillment center workers and truck drivers if they choose to, because now they can give out stock in increments of, you know, say $120 instead of $2,400. So it really provides a lot more flexibility for investors who are individuals who want to buy one share, and for employees who they want to compensate and keep motivated so they can give them one share. So I think the stock will probably go up on this. More importantly, though, this shows that management actually cares. And I think they have a reputation, very well-earned reputation, for not caring about Wall Street. And this is a very investor-friendly thing to do. So I think it's a signal from Andy Jassy, who has been absent as far as investors are concerned, that maybe he does care about the share price, and we're going to see it start to go up.
Very interesting. I am curious, when you're thinking about management, exit today, Michael, the Amazon CEO of the worldwide consumer, Dave Clark, resigns. Are you thinking about Andy Jassy coming in, shaking up other sort of C-suite areas, the impact that that may have?
You know, if you had to pick one area of Amazon that was not doing poorly, it was that one. So I would say that, you know, consumer has been great. Actually, they're great on everything they do on the revenue side. Where they're out of control is the expense side. And to be perfectly honest, I don't think it is Dave Clark's fault or anybody else's fault. I think it's Jeff Bezos and Andy Jassy's fault, because they have a bunch of skunk work projects that they're not going to tell us about. And they're investing a ton of money in things that may not pay off for 10 or 20 years. As an example, I think Amazon Fresh self-service stores is just a ridiculously stupid idea. We don't shop at Amazon so we can get in our car and drive to a store. And, you know, not having to deal with a clerk at checkout isn't the reason that I shop at Amazon. Mm. So I think these guys have a lot of spending cuts to make. I don't think Dave Clark was the guy to make those cuts. It's Andy Jassy. So he should be much more self, you know, introspective and be more self-aware and start worrying about what he's doing as CEO. The bigger problem is that they're losing employees up and down the ranks because they don't pay enough, and they're being poached by competitors. So if they're going to get rid of somebody in the C-suite, get rid of the head of HR, because that person has not done a good job.
interesting. Okay, so we're getting into some of the idiosyncratic issues within Amazon. But Michael, I thought it was really interesting. One of your counterparts, Brent Thill over at Jefferies, I think I spoke with him last week, and he said that sentiment on broader tech has never been worse, that they're doing backflips at the Exxon shareholders meeting. And you go to these tech conferences and sentiment is horrible. Is a lot of this maybe sort of the broad sentiment around technology in general?
Yeah, my largest personal holding is ExxonMobil, so I've been doing backflips as well. there's two types of tech. You know, there's tech that's not profitable. And so when you're paying a revenue multiple for companies like Unity, and I love Unity, you know, it's a genuinely great company, but they don't have profits. There is no bottom. I mean, who knows how to value that thing? Then there are tech companies like Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google, that are immensely profitable. Mm-hmm. And so it's really easy to kind of step in when you think they've gone down enough. And I think that where Jassy has control is he can say, I'm going to take earnings per share up 10 bucks by slowing our spending on some of these projects that aren't going to pay off for 10 years. If he does that, I think the stock has the potential to go right back to where it was. So let's see what these tech leaders do, but the profitable companies should lead the rebound, and the big guys tend to be pretty profitable.
Really appreciate it. All of your smart analysis. Michael Pachter, Managing Director of Equity Research over at Wedbush Securities. And just a note, I know that we were talking about the CEO, Andy Jassy, there. Stay tuned on Wednesday, 2:30 p.m. Eastern at the BTech Summit. We will have a live interview, of course, with him there. So make sure to tune in for that. Lots of great interviews coming up at that BTech Summit. In the meantime, lots of great interviews coming up right here, right now. We are one step closer, of course, for Elon Musk overcoming those hurdles for a Twitter takeover. That conversation is next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Twitter passed a U.S. antitrust review, clearing another step in its hurdle for the acquisition by Elon Musk in that proposed $44 billion deal. However, the transaction, it is still subject to acceptance by Twitter shareholders and other regulatory reviews. Joining us now, Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow, sticking around late for us on a Friday. And how much of this sort of hurdle today was expected?
Yeah, it was expected, and to a large extent, it's rubber stamping. You know, essentially, the provision means that when a piece of M&A happens like this, both parties have to give the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division of the DOJ 30 days to review the deal. And all this regulatory filing showed us is that that 30-day period has elapsed, or the regulators went back to the parties and said, you pass the checks, you can proceed. But as we know, you know, regulators are looking at other elements at this. For example, the timing of when Elon Musk started to build up his stake in Twitter ahead of that offer to buy the company.
Interesting, Ed. The share price is at 40.
Yes.
That is a far cry from the 54.20. Are there real concerns that this may not get done?
Yeah, you know, certainly the rubber stamping news of Friday moves us towards a place where we think it's more likely to get done. You know, we're talking about the spread here, right? The difference between the current share price, $40 a share, and the $54.20 per share offer that Elon Musk made. The basic rule being the wider that gets, it's a soft indication of skepticism on Wall Street is going to happen. That if that gap closes, we're moving towards a place where it's more likely to happen. It's just a soft indication. You also have like merger arbitrage specialists that put odds on the deal. And at some point, the odds on this deal happening have been below 40%. They've now improved. The question is, does he come back in with a lower offer? And it seems like given today's news, that's unlikely to be the case.
Interesting. So the hurdle then that's now on Twitter, shareholders, what right. would be anything for them to not vote for it?
Yeah, this is a psychological question more than anything. Mm-hmm. You know, at $54.20 a share, you would lick your lips at that offer. That's a great offer if you're an existing shareholder of Twitter, because the trading in Twitter hasn't really mirrored what we've seen in broader markets, right? Because it's been subject to M&A and a take private bid, it hasn't traded with the wild swings and big drops like we've seen in other social media stocks. So yeah, wait and see.
Really appreciate it. Our very own Ed Ludlow. Coming up, stick with us. Equality and inclusion in the workplace. We're going to speak with Virudhal Guris, CEO Bobby Reset, about her mission to represent underrepresented groups at her company. And that really important conversation is next. This is Bloomberg.
Lots happening on Wall Street.
It's the basic law of economics.
It validated what the market was already pricing.
Need to catch up?
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin.
We've got the information and insights.
David, you just hit the nail right on the head.
From businesses most influential and instrumental.
And that's the way you run good risk management.
It's a challenging dynamic.
We could continue to see that kind of strength.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week premieres Friday with replays all weekend on Bloomberg Television and Radio.
Technology. I'm Taylor Riggs in New York, in for Emily Chang. And this week started the Pride Month, of course. Bloomberg Television focusing on a wide range of topics, highlighting what equality means for the economy, companies, and well investors. Virudhal Guris, it is a talent as a service solution platform that matches its users with the perfect North American remote assistants and freelancers by using matchmaking algorithms. CEO Bobby Reset is on a mission to create employment opportunities for underrepresented individuals. She has, of course, a mandate within her own company that 95% of the workers identify as female, 65%, of course, by the BIPOC community, and 45% as part of the LGBTQ plus community. Bobby, so pleased to say, joins us now and talk to us sort of as we kick off Pride Month and sort of a renewed focus on equality. And it's not lost on us that today is also Jobs Day as well, and continuing to see underrepresented individuals maybe not quite have the same opportunities as others. What do you really see as sort of the way to help move that forward?
Hi, thank you so much. I think all companies are starting to gear towards inclusion and diversity in the workplace. At least we're seeing it a lot more now here in Canada. We obviously have a lot more work to do, and I think it's important that employers such as tech companies mostly need to really focus on putting that diversity out there right up front for everybody in their team to see and what they're working on, put their numbers on their site. I think all of this is extremely important so that we can show everybody that they are welcome no matter what.
This is a technology show as well, so we're focused on equality across the board. We're really looking at highlighting it within the tech sector as well. Do you see that the tech sector has maybe lagged or struggled? And how do you sort of see this sector as being able to match other areas?
I absolutely have. Down here in Canada, it took me more than 170 no's just to raise my seed round, which is obviously before the Series A funding round that we just closed. But I want to say that all of that wasn't because of who I am as a person. I'm an Indigenous LGBT woman. And, being an Indigenous LGBT woman in tech, but let alone a CEO of a very large scale, I've seen a lot of the barriers. I've had to push through a lot of them. I've seen, so much that it's been difficult for me to be able to scale the company, knowing that people weren't believing in me because of who I am. So that's one of the reasons why Virtual Gurus focuses so much on diversity and inclusion and workplace. So we hire people from all walks of life. And all of our talent are people that have a story. Every single one of them has a story, whether they're a landed immigrant to somebody who might be transitioning genders who can't find work because of it, to to people who are veterans and might have social anxiety because of PTSD, and to people with mental health issues as well. And this is important that you're giving them a safe space to work. And I felt that using our platform for that was the best thing to do.
Has anything gotten better, particularly since COVID, in a sort of renewed focus that we've all had on more equality?
I think so, especially because of the remote work. Remote work is here to stay, and everybody's obviously figured that out with COVID, and everybody's is not afraid to hit it head on as they were before. But I still think there's a lot going on. I still think that there's a lot of people being told no because of who they are. And I think, like I said earlier, that if it starts with one business just making that change and not being afraid to make that change and standing out and shouting those numbers out, just like how we shout out our 95% identifies women and 65% identify as part of the LGBTQ community. It's important to put that out so that people are seeing that. And so I've noticed a lot more tech companies that are hiring remotely are hiring a lot more diverse populations, but I think there's obviously still a lot of work to do.
And you talk about remote work, and I am curious, has that sort of opened up the labor pool that instead of access to the individual city, the remote work now is access to a talent pool across the whole country, maybe across the whole world? How have you seen within your company sort of the ability to use remote work to your advantage?
So Virtual Gurus is a talent as a service platform. So what we do is we provide marginalized and underrepresented folks through the platform, and we match them with a business or an entrepreneur. Some of our largest clients come from the US, and we will provide anywhere from 100 to 200 to 300 virtual assistants for them. And a lot of them are actually coming to us because of our equality and our diversity. And they're actually saying, hey, you know what? We want 200 people of diverse backgrounds. And so we're noticing a lot more of that is coming out. The difference with us, though, is that a lot of companies like us offshore, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but for us, we promise to keep it onshore to North America. So while we're going global, all of our workers will always remain in US or Canada, so we can keep it on our North American economy and keep it down here.
You mentioned sort of your own struggles. I am curious with the VC funding world. There's been a lot from abroad, economic environment. We've been hearing that investors are saying to their portfolio companies, conserve cash, slow down, be prepared to not be able to fundraise for a while, be prepared to hold on to just the debt, whatever cash that you have on hand. Have you found the fundraising environment generally a little bit better, particularly for minority-owned businesses, such as yours? How have you experienced sort of that VC funding in maybe a post-COVID environment now?
No, honestly, for us, it's been good. I just closed my Series A funding round about a month ago, and it only took me 6 months to open and close it directly full. So I actually had no problem. Now, the difference is I did gear away from VCs and kind of went more into impact VCs because what we're creating is impact. We are, like I said, providing work to marginalized communities that a lot of people are not doing. So we were able to target the impact investors, which really made it a lot easier on us. That said, one of my investors just geared us up and said, we're almost heading in towards a recession, and the economy is changing, and it's changing fast, and the cost of living is changing, and we all know that. So as far as going into our Series B, we're probably going to get in there a little bit faster than later. because you obviously got to make sure you protect your run rate. So we're working hard on that, and we're probably looking to jump into it within the next 8 months as opposed to 12, 14 months like we were planning on.
Well, we wish you the best of luck in that funding round and really sort of important comments when we think about equality and, of course, sort of the fundraising environment in the midst of sort of a slowing macroeconomic environment as well. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Bobby Reset of Virtual Gurus. Really appreciate it. For our crypto report, I want to start with Bitcoin dropping back below the 30,000 mark. This is after sort of it regained that closely watched level just a day ago. Our crypto contributor, Shanali Bostic, here with more. And Shanali, is this sort of a classic risk-off sort of sentiment again?
Yeah, you're looking at the S&P that was down another week. But if you look at it, Taylor, something interesting, even with the 24-hour decline in Bitcoin of about 2%, you actually have over a 7-day period, a 3% rise in Bitcoin. We should look at what this downturn really looks like in the context of other stocks as well. Because as we know, this rout in Bitcoin is really hurting other companies that are exposed to Bitcoin. One company that many investors and crypto employees are talking about is Coinbase, where there was a very steep sell-off today, and they are trading below where they were a week ago and getting much closer to that 50% drop over a one-month period. Remember, Coinbase had said that they would be rescinding some offers as well as instituting a hiring freeze. There are other stocks out there that are still also trading lower on the week. They have not said anything necessarily about hiring, but you look at a Riot blockchain or a Block, and you wonder how the stock pressure will impact their plans moving forward, Taylor.
Really appreciate it, Shanali. Stick with me here, because I'm going to bring in our next guest for more insight on this. Tegan Klein, of course, the co-founder of Edgenode, the company behind the Graph Protocol. You think of them as the Google of blockchains. And before we get into the nitty-gritty, I'm curious how you think about the volatility surrounding the price action and the calls that it's going to go to 400,000 and then calls that, well, maybe actually Bitcoin's only worth 8,000. How does all of that volatility impact you?
Yeah, it doesn't really. I've learned about Bitcoin in 2011, so I've been used to this volatility, and we kind of prepare for it, embrace ourselves within the crypto space for that volatility, and we're just focused on building.
Speaking of building, Tegan, how do you think about this in terms of all the companies out there that had these really tremendous hiring plans like Coinbase and now saying that they may rescind some offers? How does that impact the inclination of certain people who maybe were not in crypto before but were thinking about crypto and now might be more spooked by some of these knee-jerk reactions ahead?
No, I think that that's a fair response, but I do notice that there are still many projects hiring within the space. Coinbase is a multi-thousand person company, and so with volumes down, exchanges are impacted. And so it sounds like they just want to hunker down for a bit, but there are many projects that are building within the space. And one thing that's really interesting about the crypto ecosystem is that you don't need companies that are thousands of people wide unless it's a bridge to the space like Coinbase. You can have companies that are much smaller, so a few dozen to a few hundred. And then it's less impactful when there are times like this. So I wouldn't lose steam. I think that it's still quite optimistic within the space and just with the potential that crypto and Web3 have.
Well, what are the kinds of companies you think will be able to hire most, Tegan? Where can a person who wants to get a lot of crypto skill gain that crypto expertise in a crypto winter?
Yeah, I mean, we're still hiring at Edgenode, and we work on the Graph protocol. Many core developers within the Graph ecosystem are also hiring. And I think there are many protocols, like look at Arweave, look at Kinext. We still need talent. And it's actually in a market like this, it's easier to get talent. The price tags for talent were really rising up during the bull market. And so it is a good opportunity for projects and companies to be very decisive about who they want to hire and the roles that they really need to hire for in a time of uncertainty within the broader macro environment. Many projects are still hiring.
How do you think about the inherent conflict of decentralization on companies that are getting bigger and bigger who might need authority and centralization over a product?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think in Web3, you really want to give that power away. You want to give that power back to the user. And that's really what this is about. But that doesn't mean that centralized companies won't go away. They'll just exist in the concept of decentralization. And the Graph Protocol is a great example of this. There are over five companies, one of which is Edge and Node, that exist within the context of that protocol. And now that we have these new monetization structures, we're able to get rid of the kind of wonky monetization models like ads and kind of making users the product, like what we see a lot in Web 2 within the Web 3 space. And so that's exciting.
The Graph has been referred to as the Google of blockchains, and you've announced a Web 3 browser. So how is that kind of browser going to be different than Google itself?
Yeah, so great question. So Geo is the browser that was announced yesterday, and it is a decentralized browser. It's the first browser of Web3, so very different than any browser that we're used to in the Web2 space. And Web3 is really a new web. It's a verifiable web. And so you can think of like a Google Docs form where you can see all the change history. That's how Geo works. And so anyone can contribute to changes. However, there's reputation within Geo. And so the more you vote, the more, and you can earn more reputation over time, and you have more say. So it's really about giving the power, the control, the ownership, the decision-making all back to the user. And everyone's been asking, where's Web3? I can't find it. Well, now with Geo, you can.
So what about the Web2 companies that are getting more into Web3 and starting to dip their toe into blockchain in a bigger way? Do you think that the traditional Web2 companies, Meta, Google even, do you think that they can create a lot of competition in this space?
I don't. I think that Google's doing very well selling ads. I think they are doing a great job in that current space. I think once you, as a founder, once you take equity or once you start monetizing in one way, it's really difficult to reshape that monetization. You have a lot of stakeholders. And so I think they would need to kind of like spin out or enable this space in some way. And even with banks, right? Like banks aren't going away. You still want someone to call you when you're, if you have a margin trade out and you're about to get liquidated. And so there's still a lot of room for the traditional companies to exist within the space. It'll just be in a different context.
You know, we talked about crypto winter in the vein of hiring, but what about crypto winter in terms of the types of projects that will be built? Do you think this is the opportunity for crypto to pivot? Are there going to be different types of projects than we saw in the last couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, so all the pieces of the tech stack are there. We're still building, and I'm actually really excited about this cool off because so many founders and projects were being pulled in 90 different directions in the bull market. And now you see the projects that are really being used, and it kind of comes back to fundamentals as opposed to the marketing that went in during that bull market. And so you're pulled in less directions and you're able to just build. And I think the biggest piece to the puzzle is really time. And now with this market, we have that time.
Really appreciate it. Tegan Klein, co-founder of Edge and Node, of course, and our very own Bloomberg, Shanali Bosick. Really appreciate both of you joining me here today. Coming up, after 2 years of being virtual, Apple's WWDC event, it is back. It kicks off Monday. We are going to be live in Apple Park, and we have sort of the latest on what to expect. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor, QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
The Apple Worldwide Developer Conference, it kicks off Monday in person for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic. The tech giant holds it each year to show off new features and device enhancements that developers can harness with their apps. Joining us now, Ben Bajarin, Principal Analyst and CEO at Creative Strategies, a consumer tech research company. So, okay, hit it with me first. What is sort of the key thing that you're really looking forward to on Monday?
Yeah. Apple's WWDC is always an interesting event because it's the one sort of place where they do give a little bit more of a roadmap to the future, not the long off future, but stuff that's coming this fall. So they'll preview everything new that's coming to iOS, iPadOS, macOS, stuff like that, maybe tvOS. So it's generally always a software focused event. I know we talk a lot about hardware, but I don't know how much hardware will really be at this event. It's not typically what Apple does with WWDC, but really just talking to developers, showing them the vision for the platform, where they're going so that they can start to take advantage of new SDKs and APIs, create new apps on whatever new bells and whistles they're bringing to the platform. So that's usually what I'm looking at the most is how are they evolving their platforms forward. And then things around if a piece of hardware shows up or something else is usually kind of icing on the cake.
Would that be in the form of a new headset?
I don't think so. I would not expect that. I would caution others to not expect that. I mean, personally, I'm not sure the technology is there yet, even from stuff I've seen demo and tech-wise. It's just not there. So I would caution away from that. But that being said, Apple does have a toolkit called ARKit that they're continuing to try to gain momentum for and get developers to start using more. So it'll be interesting to see if they launch anything new around ARKit that might give us some signals about where they're going. But really, again, it's about getting developers to take advantage of those tools, those technologies, and create new apps. And in this case, maybe more AR apps, but they'll be smartphone-based.
When we talk about the apps, our own internal reporter, Mark Gurman, has done a lot of research and looking at maybe a new iOS 16, the way it can interact with the user. How do you think about the iOS system, the 16?
Yeah, I think it would be really interesting. I mean, that could be, in my opinion, one of the bigger surprises if there's a user interface overhaul, something that's flashy and new that we can get excited about. You know, iOS is great. It's evolved quite a bit of time. It's really only gone through a couple of serious, I would say serious, user interface overhauls. So people have argued that we're due for one to make it more flashy and new. Because that's the thing I think that's really interesting about this platform in general, Apple's approach to it, is this event really signals all of the new features and functionality that they bring to their customer space, right? Basically making all of their customers' devices better with a software update. And so what might that look like with something that's kind of brand new? I think that would be an interesting surprise. Again, it's hard to expect that, but that's the kind of thing that I think people would get really excited about as a fresh look for iOS.
This is also a company that has done a huge amount of work to bring the chip design in-house. How much of that is control over your own destiny versus some comments on the supply chain that are still a little bit difficult in this environment?
I think it's primarily driven by control of destiny. I mean, I think Apple looks at the entirety of their product roadmap from software, services, and hardware. They always have a vision for that, where they want to go. And they take that and build silicon with that vision in mind, right? The silicon team is in lockstep with the hardware planning team, the software planning team, and services. So it's really a comprehensive whole. No doubt their supply chain images are issues, but the reality is, even with Apple's internal design of these chips, they're not going to be immune to the supply chain issues. Hopefully they can try to manage that better. But absolutely, Apple Silicon is a critical part of moving their hardware device strategy forward in everything, including some things that are new in the future, whether that's headsets or whatnot, it'll all be Apple Silicon based.
Do you see any sort of macro issues, the supply chain snarls, the shutdowns of some of the factories in China starting to impact this company in a significant way?
I don't know about a significant way, but we're definitely worried about some impact. I mean, there's no doubt that the China market has slowed down quite a bit, even just consumers buying there, and China is a big part of Apple's business. So I do think people are starting to caution a little bit about what do you expect in terms of a hardware impact. Again, that's not demand going away. That's just people either not being able to get outside and buy phones. That's, you know, supply chain or factories being shut down, not being able to make them. And so across the board, and I think this is true really of all consumer electronics as a category, these aren't necessarily lost sales. These are just delayed sales. But that being said, it's going to have an impact, right, in a short term to some degree.
Really appreciate it. Ben Herron, Principal Analyst and CEO over at Creative Strategies. Really appreciate it. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Tune in Monday. BTech live from the WWDC. You don't want to miss it. This is Bloomberg.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.